You are listening to an audio recording of an event hosted by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. On February 2, 2011, Ambassador John Everard presented his research as part of the Academic Paper Series at the KEI Conference Facility. Ambassador Everard is currently a Pantech Fellow at Stanford University. His paper was titled The Markets of Pyongyang.
Well, welcome, everyone. Happy Groundhog's Day. Thank you for joining us today, and glad to see that you all made it. My name is Nicole Finneman, and it is my honor to welcome you all, as well as our very distinguished guest here today. Today's program kicks off our 2011 year of the Academic Paper Series. As many of you now know, our paper series is something that is starting in its fifth year, and it always ends in this pretty book called On Korea. Stay tuned. This month we will be releasing the fourth edition of On Korea that includes all of our papers from last year. That book will be, I think, orange, and that's coming out shortly. It's at the printer. So the Academic Paper Series, for those of you who don't know, is a series we run throughout the year. We publish roughly 10 papers, always of unique topics that are timely and policy relevant. This is something that we issue a call for papers for and receive proposals. Every once in a while, we receive a proposal that takes us less than 30 seconds to know we want to publish, as is today's event an example of. Now, the reason you're all here, the gentleman sitting next to me and our 40th author in this paper series is the distinguished and true diplomat, Ambassador John Everard. You have his bio in front of you. He's currently at Stanford University as a Pantech Fellow serving this year. And I would have to say that I do not consider the man sitting next to me a true diplomat because of all of his hard work in Belarus, Bosnia, West Africa, Beijing, Uruguay, and the reason we're all here today, North Korea. But I consider him such because we've had some months of heated debate over British versus American vocabulary in his paper. He was kind enough to concede on the spelling of some words, so there are a few extra, or a few less E's in the paper, etc. We've had some fun with that. And the one thing I will mention that you don't have in front of you, that his bio doesn't refer to, is that I have just heard him speak wonderful Korean, and apparently he has Mr. Kim to thank for quite a lot of that as his former Korean teacher, but had to slip that in there. So Ambassador Everard will give his presentation, and following that, we will open to discussion and question and answers, for which we have microphones, and I encourage you all to participate in that. So, without further ado, Ambassador Everard, okay. I give you the podium.
Nicole, thank you very much for that very warm introduction. Is this microphone working correctly? Everybody at the back can hear me? Yes? Oh, okay, that's good, thanks. Yes, I ought to make clear that I intend to make this presentation in British English. If anybody does struggle, I'm sure Nicole will provide simultaneous interpretation here. Our time is fairly limited. My experience in interacting with people who are interested in North Korea, such as I'm sure all you are, is that the really interesting bit is the question and answer session after the presentation. So I hope to keep the presentation itself fairly short. And on the presentation, could I just recall my profound thanks to KAI and particularly to the technical team who, although as you walk through the door of this august institution, everything seemed sort of calm and orderly, were working furiously with me up until the last minute to recover all the pictures which had sort of gone AWOL from my presentation stick. So thanks to them, we do actually have an illustrated presentation. The markets of Pyongyang. This is a picture of an American haggling in a Pyongyang market. I'm afraid it is quite old. It was taken in 1950, which was kind of the last time you guys were there. But it's strange, actually, how little the scenes have changed. The clothing worn by the woman there and the headscarf is typical to this day of the kind of things that you see being worn in Pyongyang markets. The markets are fascinating simply because they exist. I think it's important to remember that the North Korean regime has an ideology which has no place for markets. The state is supposed to provide all citizens' needs through non-market mechanisms. And finding that markets were actually necessary to allow the people of North Korea to have access to basic foodstuffs was a tremendous ideological blow to the regime. In fact, the markets in North Korea have been through two phases. They were originally opened in 1984. Under Chinese pressure, a fact that in the present situation on the peninsula we might do well to remember, where the Chinese effectively made clear to the North Korean regime, to Kim Il-sung, that they were going to have to reform and to open up part of their economy. Kim Il-sung winced, said that they would reform, but only in certain limited ways. And one of the reforms was the opening of markets around the DPRK. Then, 1987, Hu Yaobang fell from power, and within nanoseconds, the DPRK closed all the markets again. Once the pressure was off, they simply reverted to type. But then, not long after that, the famine started. I mean, there are people in this room, some of whose faces I recognize, who know far more about the famine in North Korea of the 1990s than I do. I won't bore you, therefore, with exegesis. But one of the side effects was that as the state control of food and food distribution started to break down, that people started to open markets themselves and to trade in a way that the Juche ideology simply did not foresee, so that we have a return of the markets in the 1990s. Originally, the markets seem to have been really quite simple affairs. You would be looking at limited numbers of people gathered on scraps of ground with blankets, sheets, whatever, on which they would have food set out, very ad hoc. But as you can see from this photograph, once they were established, they started to grow. In 2002, the economic measures actually permitted markets so that they became legal. And not long after that, in 2003, the DPRK regime issued instructions on how markets should look, what they should do, and gave, as the slide there says, directives on their management. The picture there is of an inside of a market. I'm pretty sure that it is Tongil Market, though I'm not completely sure. It might be Central District. Could I just point out, all the salespeople are women. This is typical in North Korean markets. There is a directive that only women should be allowed to trade, or perhaps it's that only women are, or that trading by men is discouraged, as so often in the DPRK, the difference between the two isn't always entirely clear. Notice, not entirely clear in this photograph, but this woman is wearing a patterned apron here, and you can see the colours of all the others' women's straps. They are all wearing the same apron. North Korean markets are well organised. They're colour-coded. This, in this market, is the coding for, evidently, the vegetable section. And as you wander into other parts of the market, you will find that people are wearing yellow smocks, green smocks, whatever it might be. This also means, of course, that enterprising traders who feel like trading electronic goods one morning rather than vegetables can't do so because they're wearing the wrong colour smock. All very carefully organised. There are two markets in Pyongyang which are immediately visible to foreigners. One is Tongil Market, which some of you who have been to Pyongyang may well have visited. Groups of visitors are quite often taken there. This is a photograph of the other one, Central District Market. As you can see, it is a substantial structure. And you can see the rows of windows there. Typically, each section would be sort of three or four windows, and there are three aisles, I think it is, inside Central District Market. So it is a big place. Several hundred women trade there, and as you can see, there's quite a flux of people walking in and out. Although this market is visible, it's not open to foreigners unless you're resident. Now, why on earth that should be, I don't know, any more than I, or as far as I know, anybody else really understands why the DPRK decided to build two large markets in very obvious open locations and then hide all the others, which is what they did. The markets of Pyongyang, you have to know where they are. They are hidden behind apartment blocks, and the only way you can find them if you don't know where they are is usually by tagging on to the stream of people who walk in there with empty bags and just hope that the market police don't stop you. These people, the ones sitting down there, are money changers. Outside the markets, outside pretty much every market in Pyongyang, you get gaggles of these people, usually many more than are on that photograph. Maybe the others were on their break or something, who will stand with a big bag containing wadges of foreign currency and who will change one into euros, euros into one, increasingly one even into filthy, stinking American imperialist dollars, if that's really what you want. They still, when I left in 2008, they were still a bit shy about changing with foreigners, but that is where all the North Koreans I knew got their money from. There also used to be a subsidiary of BAT, British American Tobacco, in Pyongyang, who remitted profits by taking large wadges of high-denomination won banknotes, going to the money changers all around Pyongyang, and buying sufficient foreign currency to remit their profits, which meant that they would always be banked in great heaps of sweaty, dirty banknotes. There was quite an occasion when the BAT people would actually come into the bank. These are therefore quite big affairs, these markets. They provide services other than just buying and selling, money changing, as I said, but they are also, importantly, centres of gossip. That if you put, we have, I think, ethnic Koreans in the audience here. If you put two or more Koreans together, you have a talk shop. And that applies to North Koreans just as does to South. If you put an entire market full of Koreans together, it's impossible to stop them talking. And you see people wandering from stall to stall, no doubt checking out prices and, you know, making sure they get a good deal. But also, of course, every time they move to a different stall, they will chatter to the stallholder. And markets, therefore, act as kind of foci for gossip, for information. Probably the least restricted environment in which information can travel within North Korea. I referred just now to the May 2003 directions on the establishment of markets. For those of you who have never seen a secret North Korean document, this is what they look like. And you can see Pimil in the top right-hand corner, secret. It's one in the North Korean system of classifications. It's one below the top. They also have a kind of most or top secret classification. And this was the actual document circulated instructing cadres to go and set up markets. It is for a regime that at one point was attempting to abolish money, a quite extraordinary document and a clear very clear demonstration of the bankruptcy of the North's ideology. This is just the front page. The document is, I think it's 16 pages long, and contains all kinds of detailed regulations on the fact that they're supposed to have roofs, that you have to have a lavatory, the amount of space required, and so on and so forth. I've mentioned that they are that markets represent a retreat from the state's responsibility to feed its citizens. They are an ideological threat to the regime in that sense. They are also a threat because, as I said, they act a sense of gossip, but also in allowing the growth of markets, the regime has allowed the growth of an entire class of traders who have income which does not depend on the North Korean state, who have access to information. It's very hard to trade in markets without it, who often have foreign contacts. A lot of the things traded in markets come from abroad. In this market, that I'm pretty sure is Tongil, you see these clothes. These will all have been imported from China, so that the traders there have, at some way along the chain, they have contacts with people who cross the border to get these things from them. So you've already got a group there which is difficult to control. Then, in November 2009, the regime committed the foolish mistake of trying to suppress the markets. This was the great the economic measures of that month, where, as you'll recall, the regime remonetized the currency, causing a lot of the market traders to lose their savings. In May last year, the regime had formally to backtrack, to recognize that it could not stop the markets, it could not, in its own words, solve the food problem, a stunning omission by the regime, and it allowed all the traders back in. So you've now got a group of people who have all the characteristics that I've described, plus they are now really angry with the regime. They've lost money, they've lost several months trading, and they are unlikely to be well disposed. It's a pretty potent mixture to have sitting in central Pyongyang. Frog markets. There are two kinds of market in Pyongyang. I've been talking so far about the official markets, the ones legitimized in the May 2003 directive, which I showed you just now. On top of them, all round the city, there are unofficial markets called frog markets because they're illegal. The market traders, all women, will stand ready or squat ready to jump up and leave the market at the first sign of trouble. The Koreans say that they look like frogs because they just jump like that. So frog markets they are. Giguri jamadang. And this is a lady trading in one of those markets. As you'll see, she's selling fruit with... Yeah, in fact, she's got all fruit there, hasn't she? It looks rather good fruit, doesn't it? And that is typical. Inside the official markets, there is an extraordinary and growing variety of goods. We saw just now on the slide in Tongil Market quite a variety of clothes. There would also be electronic goods for sale elsewhere, furniture of various kinds. You can buy complete bathroom fittings in a market. I once saw an electric organ for sale, musical instruments, and so on and so forth. The frog markets concentrate, however, on food. They're fiercely competitive. You don't survive long in a frog market if you sell bad food. So, you know, free market competition keeps standards up. But they also represent an incredible act of open defiance of the regime. These markets are illegal. That woman who was sitting there being photographed, as it happened, by a French photographer, was doing so in defiance of clear police instructions. And thousands of women do this every day around the DPRK. The frog markets were hit badly by the monetary reforms of 2009, but and they still haven't fully recovered. in Pyongyang, for example, they have been there are a lot fewer of them in the city center, but there are now some restarting themselves on the outskirts of the city. This is an act of mass disobedience, which the regime appears either unwilling or unable to control. I wanted also to show you this picture of an equally typical frog market. This was actually taken in May 2010, so some time after the November 2009 measures. As you'll see, this was in central Pyongyang under a bridge. It's a fairly typical scene. There was a ban in 2007 on women under 50 trading in markets. I think she's quite a long way under 50. And some of the others also, she's probably sort of late 40s, that the ban was ignored within a few weeks of its implementation. Another example of the way that the regime's control is being eroded. So young women trading here, those are cigarettes, and that I'm pretty sure is beer. You quite often find women under road bridges also selling soju. Not the nice, gentle soju you get in South Korea. North Korean soju is serious stuff and will get you very paralytically very quickly. And when I was there, a bottle of soju only cost 500 won at a time when a euro would buy you about 4,500. So, you know, if you're a serious drinker, North Korea is a good place to be. Yes. Also on that, the young lady there is selling cigarettes. In ordinary tobacco is widely traded in the markets. In North Korea, they distinguish between two grades of tobacco. One just ordinary tobacco and the other poison tobacco, as it's called, which is very cheap. You can get 100 grams for 500 won. 100 grams is a lot of tobacco. I don't smoke, but I once bought a bag of this stuff and gave it to a friend of mine, a foreign friend, who used to roll his own cigarettes, and invited him to try it. I didn't see him for a couple of days afterwards. And when I did and asked if he wanted to try any more, he sort of held up both hands and walked slowly backwards out of the room, which suggests that it's not something that you treat lightly. Coming to the end. So what next? The regime has had to back down from the reforms it tried to put through in November 2009. It's admitted that it can't live without the market. It can't solve the food problem by itself. And it's thereby admitted that there's a huge hole in its ideology. This grates. The regime depends for its legitimacy on the goodwill, if not the active support, of at least the outer elite in Pyongyang, who now know that it's stepping down from its own ideological positions. It's a massive failure. And as I said, the regime is now confronted by this class of traders around Pyongyang who are going to be frankly hostile and who got independent incomes. For a regime at a fragile period, this is very bad news. I think, if I may, I'll leave the presentation at that point to leave a little more time for questions and answers. Thank you for your attention.
All right. Well, thank you, Ambassador Everard. We have, we're just getting set up here with microphones. So I will let, it looks like, Brett and Jennifer get those so that we can make sure that you're all heard, both on camera and by us. And Brett, if you're ready, we'll actually start up here in front because I see Jonathan Pollock's hand up. I guess I could have snuck one of my own in.
I can speak without the mic, if that's okay.
If you don't mind, for the podcast, we would love to get your audio. I should mention, for if you're a Bill Murray fan, that if you get the question wrong, we will repeat the program over and over.
Thank you. Ambassador Everard, good to see you again. One of the big questions that we confront when we see vignettes or hear of anecdotes is to get a sense of proportionality, the scale of these activities, recognizing that there are no doubt significant variations from location to location. Is there any way, based on what you know and have seen or what others have told you, particularly since you left, to get a sense of just how essential and large a role markets, either state-sanctioned or private and informal, do play in Korea's economy, North Korea's economy, particularly with reference to food, but also with reference to consumer goods? I know that's a large order question, but it's very difficult at times to conceptualize exactly how much are we seeing, what are we seeing, how widespread, and so forth.
Sure, yes, I'll try to answer that. I mean, the quick answer is, of course, I don't know. But the markets are a very large operation. I had up before a picture of a central district market, which was roughly typical, I think, in terms of the scale of these things. In my experience, there's at least one official market of that kind for every guyok, for every district in Pyongyang. There may be more. Plus, you have the frog markets, which vary in size. Some frog markets, well, the one we saw just now was, what, three or four people under a bridge? Others take over entire fields on the outskirts of Pyongyang and are very large organizations indeed. One of them, in fact, is just down the road from Chonglu Market itself. So you've got a very large official market and then an even larger unofficial market a few hundred meters away. How essential are they? Pretty much every North Korean I knew used the market to some extent or other. Typically in Pyongyang, and I stress that, you know, I didn't get to know people outside the capital, it would be difficult to do so. They were still getting food rations through, rice rations, in one form or another. Quite often, the rations, although you would have to sign, you receive rice, they would consist not of rice, but of rice and another grain. Sometimes, at bad times, rice and potatoes. Of course, potatoes, because of their high moisture content, have a lot less nutritive value, weight for weight, than rice does. But that was their principal food supply, still topped up by what they could buy in the markets. And even with that, they would need to buy things like cooking oil in the markets, and the price of cooking oil was a big subject of gossip. So even in 2008, markets were pretty much essential to the well-being of even members of the outer elite in Pyongyang. I gather from what I've read rather than what I saw when I was there that the public distribution system has stumbled badly, perhaps even in Pyongyang, but certainly outside the capital, which suggests that they are even more important outside the capital in relative terms to people's food intake than they are in Pyongyang itself. So it's a big thing. Mm.
Yes, right in front here, Joe.
Yes, hi, Mr. Bezos. Thank you very much. I'd like just to follow up on that. Do you have any sense of the scope of markets outside of Pyongyang? For example, is there one at least in every major city like Wonsan, or even possibly does every county have a market of some kind or another?
I'm pretty sure that there is at least one market, probably several, in every major city. I saw one in Nampo, but wasn't able to enter it. I've seen them in Chongjin. I've seen them in Wonsan. Again, you're from the outside. In Nampo, at least, you also get frog markets. You do, now come to think of it, in Chongjin. And I would hazard a guess that the further you get into the deprived and battered northeast of the country, you know, the more common the frog markets become. So I'm fairly confident the market system extends right across the country. Do you get one in each county? I can't be sure, but in rural counties, you frequently see people who haven't actually formed a market, but are simply sitting, selling stuff by the side of the road. So that markets or market-like activities pretty much go on right through the country. I remember one occasion, for example, where I was driving along, it was an arterial road, I've forgotten which one it was now, and there was a woman just sitting by the side of the road, doing nothing as far as I could see. And innocently and nosily, I stopped and said, are you okay? You know, do you want something? And she grinned broadly and, quick as you like, hopped up the bank behind her and came down dragging a huge sack of herbs, which she proceeded to try to sell me for 10,000 won. Of course, she didn't want to sit there with her wares in front of her in case the police came past, but that's what she was doing. I think it's quite a lot that goes on.
Yes, we'll go here in the middle. The gentleman, Andre. Jennifer, if you could get, we can pass it down, yeah, to Andre, and then the gentleman behind you.
Ambassador, in your conversations with North Korean officials, did you get a sense of their feelings on the markets, resignation, acceptance, hostility, any of the above?
Very difficult subject to talk about with officials. I'm pretty sure that they all use the markets, but of course they have to say that they are simply a temporary measure. And I kept having to bite my tongue from pointing out that some of them have been trading now for 20 years and that we're stretching temporary well beyond breaking point. I think some of the more ideologically correct officials probably did resent the presence of the markets. Others seemed just to accept that they were there and probably there to stay. But it wasn't a comfortable subject to discuss with them.
And right behind you.
Yes, my name is Jin Jung from Housing University School of Business. I have two parts question. Number one is for ordinary citizen or ordinary household. What percentage of daily foods, staples, or consumer goods, etc., are supplied by rationing coupon or money? That's my first part. Second part is, do you think North Korea has very solid monetary system like any country with a market? So I don't, in my opinion, they don't have any monetary policy. That's the two questions.
Well, first on the first question, we have Marcus Noland present here. I believe in Which Transformation you address some of these points. Yes, I commend Marcus's book, Everybody, Which Transformation, available in bookstores now, which gives quite a lot of useful data on that. I think in very brief, I think it varies a great deal depending where in the DPRK you are and what position you hold in society. The distribution of food through the public distribution system is very uneven, and it favors people whom the regime likes to favor. So that if you are a kind of middle-ranking cadre in Pyongyang, you are, as I've said, you're getting most of your food through the public distribution system. If you have the misfortune to live in a beat-up wreck of a town like Chongjin, then you are probably relying on the market for rather more of your food intake. Yes, Marcus is nodding. I'm relieved. The overall, though, it does seem that the ability of the public distribution system to supply people's nutritional needs is eroding. It's getting more and more difficult year by year. You've probably seen the reports by the FAO and by the World Food Programme indicating that food insecurity is bad this year and is getting worse. Money in North Korea. I was perhaps slightly surprised to find that you cannot use foreign currency in markets. You have to buy things in North Korean won. Not perhaps the most stable of international currencies, but that is their money and that is what they use. It is subject to high levels of inflation, as you probably know. It is also subject to forgery. I mean, the banknotes are not well made, and people would always, you know, if you handed anybody a bunch of 1,000 won notes, they would always check each one. religiously. I never actually handled a forged note, but it quite clearly was a major problem. And the North Korean won isn't supported by any of the mechanisms that one would normally associate with the currency. Nevertheless, it circulates and it does function as money.
To clarify, is the practice at the market to take whatever currency you have and immediately, if it's not North Korean won, change it into North Korean won to do your business at the market, and then on your way out you might change it back into something else?
No, if you try to pay in euros, the most market stallholders, they don't want to turn a customer away. You know, this is business, and they're good Koreans, and they all try to do what the customer wants. The reaction is to go and find a money changer, who will come sort of, bouncing up, beaming with a big bag of money, and they'll disappear into a corner and give you a wadge of North Korean won, which you then use to effect the transaction. What you do with the one, your change at the end of the day, of course, it is up to you.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador King, right here, Jennifer.
What are the political and social implications of the gender effect that the market has? This is mostly women. They're the ones that are getting free market training. They're the ones that are having to make economic kinds of decisions. The men are in the factories where they don't get paid much and don't do much. And what does that say in terms of what's going to happen sociologically and politically? For example, refugees who are leaving North Korea, overwhelmingly 70% women. Is this related to the market? What does it say in terms of the future and how this is going to affect the regime's ability to maintain control?
I think that's a very interesting and very, very, very good question. If I can answer the second part first, the reason I believe that the refugees are overwhelmingly women is that women tend to be simply less controlled in North Korean society. It's a very macho society. There's a kind of inherent belief that if you want anything done properly, you need a man to do it. So women, tend to sort of get out under the radar rather more easily. But yes, you are moving into a society where the women have they develop the skills, they know what prices are, and they learn how to, engage in simple business, whereas their menfolk don't. And, of course, it means they get the income. Now, some of my North Korean friends were in marriages where the man got no income. He was in one of these factories which were not paying anything, or on occasions was simply unemployed. Unemployed in people's paradise? Anyway, it does happen. And the wife was bringing in the income. And it was made clear that this was a very delicate situation. The man's face had to be preserved, whatever. And the women were constantly treading on eggshells to make sure that the man wasn't upset. Over time, though, you are going to have a society where all the people you need to integrate into the world community are women. It's going to be an interesting moment, isn't it? Yeah. Yes.
Dr. Weathersby, and then the...
Yes, thank you for a wonderful presentation. I wonder if you have any sense of the wholesale level of this operation, how goods are being brought in from China. I suspect that that's perhaps the male role yes. at the wholesale level. And also, what sort of criminal organization has been built up around this?
Okay. I tried to get a sense of how the supply chains into the market worked, but I wasn't very successful. Some of the goods for sale in market I could trace right back. Things like tobacco, the people said that they grew it on their family plots. Okay, I can understand. They then sort of come into Pyongyang, dodge all the police checkpoints, no papers, of course, sell their tobacco in the markets and go. The stuff coming from China obviously has a more complicated supply chain. I didn't get very much from Korean sources, but the local authorities in Dandong in China, so just across the border from Sinuiju, told me that you simply got North Koreans with wadges of Chinese yuan wandering around buying stuff, bailing it onto the back of trucks and taking it across the border. And they never got to find out who these people were or who they were working for. They tend to be a little bit secretive. So, you know, that's still a bit unclear. I think it's difficult to believe that there is no crime involved in anything to do with money in North Korea. The society is thoroughly corrupt. Various studies on markets have shown that in addition to the fees that they are required to pay officially, that market traders frequently have to pay bribes to local officials to be allowed to trade. So there's certainly crime to that extent. One thing I didn't find was the kind of protection racket that was so common in the latter days of the Soviet Union, and it still exists in Russia now, where you have to pay the men with big bulging shoulders a certain amount each week, or your stall gets kicked over. I can't be sure it doesn't exist, but I certainly came across no trace of it.
There's the woman three rows up from you, Jennifer, and one in. And then I saw Balbina and left. One more. I'm sorry. First, the lady right there behind you, Jennifer. Yep.
Thank you, Ambassador, for the great presentation. I was wondering if you could comment a little more in detail on the content of the gossip at the market, if at all. You mentioned the price of cooking oil briefly, and I'm just curious if it was mainly, about the price of items in the market, or if it ever ventured into social, political discussions of any kind. Did the market vendors seem to have an opinion on these different changes that you mentioned in policies related to the markets, or what sense was it? Did that conversation go beyond sort of the price of goods?
I'm confident that conversations in markets go way beyond the price of cooking oil. That people discuss everything under the sun, and certainly things like major events elsewhere in the DPRK would be talked about in markets. Rumors would come in there. Information about life outside the DPRK, of course, by their nature, people in markets are in contact with people who trade with China, so can see Dandong, which is quite a smart city now, with big skyscrapers, with their own eyes, and describe this. I didn't get the sense that much of what is actually going on in the elite got into the markets. The inner core of the regime is obsessively secretive, and information about what actually is happening at the top there is very tightly held. So perhaps not that. But things like executions, those will go through the market. The troubles in some places, floods. And I would be pretty sure that right now what they're talking about is Egypt.
Wow. Yeah. Brett, right here in the front, Balbina has a question.
Thank you. I wanted to follow up a little bit on Catherine Weatherby's question and probe you the question about the distribution.
Are you Catherine Weatherby?
Yeah. The distribution system.
Right, I bring all your stuff. Sorry.
And just probe you a little bit. My question is slightly different from hers. She was referring, I think, more to sort of the consumer goods or hard goods.
Right.
My question is about the food products, especially in the frog markets. That picture you had up there,
yeah.
What struck me was the bananas. Because,
get bananas.
Anybody who lived in South Korea in the 60s or 70s knows that bananas were impossible to find. And, it was considered an incredible thing to ever even have them because, obviously, they had to be imported. And even then, it was very, very difficult to get your hands on them. So it strikes me that, I'm wondering, it's one thing for these ladies to come out and sell whatever was growing in their orchards. But the variety of that fruit says to me that there must be some sort of distribution system in terms of the way these are being farmed. And so do you have any idea if they're coming off of collective farms? It seems to be a little bit more well-organized than that.
Oh, sure, it is well-organized. I can't imagine that those bananas were grown in the DPRK. It's simply too cold. But you can... But I would hazard, I mean, you can buy bananas in Tesco's in Dandong. Yeah? And that's probably where they came from. You know, someone goes in, you know, buys a whole shelf of these things and puts them on a lorry. In summer, when the roads are almost passable, you can get a load into a Pyongyang market in 6-7 hours, so before the bananas start to go brown. Because you probably saw the bananas, the winter bananas, they weren't even brown. Yeah, they were quite good condition, yeah. You've got to move fast, but you can do it. Well organized? Absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting, sorry, just if I can expand on that point, that amongst my various North Korean friends, nobody anymore was interested in joining the party apparatus. What they all wanted to do was to go and do Muyok, which is where all the money is, the trade organization they're building up.
If I could get you to come in the middle of the aisle, I said to Kim's hand, and then we will actually take two in this round, and then Kevin Smith back there, so you can get him. We'll take two questions. I saw a number of hands.
Okay,
yeah, sure. Fine with me. Right.
Currency market in Pyongyang, do they have a notorious the fake dollar problem?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question. What market?
Fake
dollar.
Inside the markets?
Yeah, inside the market. Currency market in Pyongyang.
The super notes? The currency markets. Oh, I'm sorry.
Do they have a notorious effect?
Counterfeit dollars.
No. You don't see much counterfeit U.S. currency in the DPRK. You have to come to America for that. they're not circulated widely. No, if you get a dollar in the DPRK, it's probably a good one.
Kevin.
Okay, is this on?
Yes, it is.
Okay. My question is about the prices of things in the various markets. I mean, especially compared to the institutionalized ones versus the frog markets. Do you pay some kind of premium to get the legitimacy of shopping in the sort of building market as opposed to going under the bridge? Phrased another way, if I want the best deal on a pair, you know, which one do I go to?
You would probably, in my experience, the quality of your notional pair is going to be better in the frog markets. But as far as I was able to compare prices, there's not a lot to choose between them. In the official markets, prices are controlled. You get a board by market entrances, not interestingly by central market for some reason, but that tells you how much everything is going to cost. And by and large, the market stallholders would actually adhere to those prices. Now, whether that is still the case in 2011 after the inflation that occurred, I don't know. But in 2008, that was still so. In the frog markets, these were illegal organizations in any case, so nobody was going to fix prices. But the ladies would quite often have little bits of cardboard or brown paper sort of stuck in front of them to indicate what price they were selling at. So the price was pre-advertised. It wasn't like markets in some other Asian countries where you go and you haggle. Where do you get the best deal? Probably the frog market, but the stuff you buy in the official markets is usually pretty good as well. Not much on price.
About enforcement of rules inside the market, is there a degree of policing and is that visible?
Yes, there is. There's the market police, usually, again, women, who will sort of either, you know, depending which market you're in, who will either sort of stomp around being officious and making themselves generally sort of unloved, or more commonly, sit in a corner drinking tea and ignore what's going on. They're simply there to keep order. As you know, these are North Koreans. They're not likely to sort of, you know, break out in massive disorder in any case, and they probably don't need that much supervision. Even in the frog markets, you know, the stallholders will agree amongst themselves who's going to sit where, so that you get, you know, the same people or people selling the same products sitting together. It all, you know, appeals to the Korean sense of good order, so that the market police didn't have much of a job, unless, of course, a foreigner turns up. Now, foreigners are allowed into Tongil Market, and they are unofficially allowed into Central District Market, and there's another market which hasn't yet sprouted a name, but is up by the Mayday Stadium, and you can go into there as well. The other markets you are not supposed to go into, but in practice, a lot of the market police just pretended they didn't see you. They couldn't care. Why should they have, you know, make life difficult? It's a foreigner. He'll come in, he'll buy some stuff, he'll go again, and no one will be any the wiser. Whereas if you stop him, then you're going to cause a bit of a scene. Everybody will talk about it, and it's all a bit difficult. So in a lot of the markets, you know, you can just wander in and out, and provided you don't actually sort of make eye contact with the market police, they won't bother you. Others, they will come up and sort of politely sort of look up at you, because, you know, these are North Korean women. They're usually about 1.50 meters, and sort of looking almost vertically up at me. And they will ask you politely to leave. You also get halfway houses. I remember distinctly one visit I made to a market where two of the police came up and said, sorry, I wasn't allowed in there, could I please leave? And I said, well, I only came to buy some apples. And they sort of looked at each other and said, apples? Oh, all right then, come on. And they took me to the apple area, and I was about to buy some apples, and they sort of slapped my fingers and said, no, not those. Those, they're much better. And they made sure that I wasn't being overcharged by the lady, and I got the right bag and passed it out. So, and chatted happily as we walked out of the market in a very sort of non-authoritarian way. And as we left the market, I said, well, thanks for your help, very kind of you. Would you both like an ice cream? And they sort of looked at each other, tempted, but decided that was just a bridge too far. They wouldn't have an ice cream. So we left at that.
Thanks. Thank you. We have two questions in the front. We'll start with the guest.
Hi there, Chad O'Carroll. I was just wondering about taxation. Is there any taxation in these official markets? Or is this all cash in hand for the producers and vendors? Do they just keep the profits? Or how does it work?
Comrade, there is no taxation in the people's paradise. I can see we have ideological deviance in our midst here. There is, however, a requirement to pay a monthly fee. Andrei Lankov, some years ago, did a bit of research into this on market vendors, and there's a scale of fees that you pay depending on what you're doing, plus bribes, as I mentioned. So there is a cost to trading in the official markets. Yes.
Do you have any sense of maybe the black market? You hear reports in some of these markets where, for example, South Korean DVDs are perhaps sold, or even South Korean rice cookers are apparently supposed to be a great hot commodity in North Korea. Did you get a sense of any kind of these contrabands being sold or in some of these markets or even in the frog markets?
I've heard that South Korean rice cookers are hot stuff. I never saw one, to be honest. South Korean DVDs, yes, but not in the markets. They have their own distribution system. They are traded by bunches of rather sleazy-looking young men at street corners.
So it's men.
These are men. Men are allowed to do DVDs. The advanced stuff like food is too difficult for them, but they are allowed to do DVDs. Sorry? Yes? Okay. I wouldn't know that, Mark. again, there's no sort of shame about this. I remember once approaching such a group of young men, and I thought that they would sort of put their DVDs away and sort of shuffle off into the distance. But no, they just stood there. And there was quite clearly, these were South Korean soap operas. You could see the pictures of the starlets. I've seen that some people here at least do watch DVDs of soap operas, you know, with all the gaudy covers you get and the names of the actresses and so on. They were all there, no shame. All they were interested in was I going to buy one? There was no sort of sense that they were in danger. Hmm. Things you don't get in markets, you don't get radios, because, of course, that the regime really would get upset about. As I imagine people in this room know, in North Korea, to legally have a radio, you have to have it adjusted so that it can receive only North Korean stations. In fact, anybody with any technical nous can change that, but you have then to explain why you've broken the seal on the back of the radio. And yes, Mr. Kwan? Yes, thank you. To any visiting police officers. So radios are not on sale. Curiously, although not in the markets, televisions are. You can go into the new shops in downtown Pyongyang and just buy a television. And it can't be that much more difficult to adjust a television to receive forbidden channels than it is to adjust a radio. But anyway, you can.
I would jump in there and say the last time my television was set only to the three North Korean channels. And
is this in Washington, D.C.?
No, or? Yeah. In Pyongyang. Okay. And when I mentioned something about it, they came up and I timed them. It took less than 10 seconds to turn a single screw in the back to be able to have all of the channels.
Thank you. That's a good illustration.
I saw a question in the back.
The other thing that you never see for sale in markets is bicycles.
Oh.
Bicycles are subversive, not just when I'm riding them, because bicycles allow villagers to travel from village to village and talk, and the regime doesn't like them being freely available. If you're a foreigner in Pyongyang, you can buy a bicycle in the friendship stores, in the special foreigner shops, but they are not for sale to ordinary North Koreans. Curiously, though, if you go to collective farms, even so, a lot of the collective farmers have bicycles, because collective farms are big places and they use them to cycle, between the fields. Mostly second-hand Japanese bicycles. One of the sad effects of Japanese sanctions on North Korea is that the country's access to second-hand Japanese bicycles has dried up, which is kind of probably hampered mobility.
Hmm. Very interesting. Yes, in the back.
Hello, I'm back here. I was just wondering, so if the markets are generating a lot of income and are providing North Koreans with a means of survival, I would imagine that there would be a high interest to participate in markets, especially the official ones, as a seller. And so I was wondering, how does one actually get to sell in these official markets, if you knew anything about that?
Yes, that's a good question, which I'm afraid I can't answer. I tried to establish this by talking around. None of the people who were prepared to talk to me regularly were able to answer the question. I mean, they weren't really the kind of people who would ever want to go and trade in markets. And when you asked the market people themselves what happened, a lot of these were sort of North Korean peasant women, and they'd simply collapse in giggles at this foreigner asking all kinds of detailed questions about how they came to be there. So I never really got a clear answer. I'm sorry.
Keith, yes. And then I saw two hands.
Yes, Mr. Ambassador. I had a similar question. It's more who sort of runs these markets, right? I mean, property is state-owned. The market's on state property. Somebody owns that property.
The Ministry of Commerce.
Yes. So I guess what I was wondering is do you have any idea who runs the markets? Is it a state group, a party group, somebody? Secondly, I wonder, I mean, how off would it be to suggest perhaps that these are sort of state collective markets versus a real market, right? I mean, the frog market would be a market, right? Because it's not regulated. But, I mean, who's to say if people are regulated, they wear uniforms, as you pointed out, this is obviously state property. I don't know. I just was wondering, could you almost imagine that this is no different than a state factory? It's just women show up to work to sell at a state market.
No, I don't think that's the case. Firstly, who owns them? The May 2003 regulations put them under the control of the Ministry of Commerce. So that's explicit. It creates all kinds of interesting tensions because department stores are run by the local city authorities, so that you've got rival organizations managing different retail outlets with all the kind of the eye-scratching that generates. Are they state-controlled market? I mean, when I go into Trader Joe's, the people there wear uniforms. It's the fact that you are, working for a large organization doesn't necessarily mean that you're not part of the free market. Sorry.
I'm sorry, the difference is everybody's working for Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Suggesting that all these women are actually working for Tongil market employees versus
Trader Joe's. Oh, I see. No, I'm pretty sure that they're not working for Tongil market, that these women will have paid their monthly fees to enable them to sit in the markets and sell whatever it is that they are selling. Some of them will be selling on their own account, selling produce from their family, probably produce from their own collective farm. Others will be working for a wider trading organization, bringing stuff in from China or wherever. Again, it's a question which I've said before. I can't really answer in any kind of detail, but I suspect that when we finally get access to this kind of information in North Korea, we'll find that, in fact, there's quite a wide variety of different models involved. But no, these are real people sending real things for the nearest thing they get to real money.
All right, yes.
Years ago in South Korea, the Bank of Korea used to publish the official rate, exchange rates between the won and other currencies for the rare official exchange, and the black market rate. This spread was of great interest to the military police, but it was also an important economic indicator showing if there was a divergence of policies. So I'm interested in your exchange guys at the market outside. Yeah. Has anybody been counting, measuring, recording the spreads between between an occasional official exchange and the black market rate?
I always used to do this when I was in Pyongyang. I'd hope that the practice has continued. The spread is absolutely huge. I mentioned that when I was there, and this is before the monetary measures in November 2009, so we're talking old money now, but you would quite often get about 4,500 won to a euro. If you went and changed a euro in the Koryo Hotel, they've got an exchange booth in the basement there, I think it was 115 won to a euro. So, I mean, a fantastically skewed exchange rate. Just as a footnote to that, at various times, a formal black market currency booth would appear in Tongil Market upstairs. It's a kind of two-level market, where on good days, even foreigners were allowed to exchange convertible currency for won. And I was told that it was actually run by the same bank as it runs the exchange booth in the Koryo Hotel. So if that's true, then the bank is simultaneously running the official and the unofficial market, which is a slightly zany state of affairs, but there we are.
Hmm. Yes, Victoria.
Ambassador, you seem to say that there are a lot of gender classifications when it comes to the market, that all of the sellers are women and the police are women. How about the customers? Are they predominantly women as well?
No. The customers look to me to be about half-half. You've got quite a lot of men coming in. Yes, you're the first person to ask me that question. You're making me think now. But yes, I did see a lot of men coming to buy things in the market, even in broad daylight when they were supposed to be at developing socialism somewhere. So, maybe in some Korean households now, the man started shopping. Interesting point.
Victoria, maybe you could pass your microphone up to Rose. We have another question.
Hi, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for your presentation. I was wondering if you could notice any U.S. or other foreign aid, rice and such, showing up in these markets. And also, if you could get a sense of how many of the female vendors also participated in the frog markets.
I doubt if, to answer the second bit first, I suspect that if you have going to pay your monthly fee, you'll use all the time you can in the official market. And unless you are very well organized and have lots of energy, you're probably not going to have much time to run a frog market stall simultaneously. Although the official markets closed at given times, and the frog markets would go on late into the night. It's one of the Pyongyang sites. In winter nights, the frog market ladies will sit there with little bluish torches, flashlights.
Thank you.
flagging up their wares and just calling Sasio, Sasio. It hangs on the Pyongyang wind. Sorry, I got so sort of taken up by an anecdote. I've got your question.
About if you've seen any U.S. or foreign aid showing up in
yes.
the markets.
Not in the official markets, but quite often you would see people selling rice, which of course is illegal, in the DPRK, in the frog markets, out of big bags, saying the Hanminguk, the Republic of Korea, or World Food Program, We Feed People, where clearly the aid had been diverted. There was never any attempt to conceal these bags, so everybody could see where the rice came from, and you know, the South Korean bags were actually written up in Korean, as everybody knew. I even, at one point, found that somebody had opened up a few of these bags and sewn them together to make a kind of roof for their balcony. So you had Republic of Korea, you know, written all across the balcony, and nobody seemed to mind very much.
Wow. We have a question in the very back, and then, yes, up here, second.
Thank you, Ambassador. You mentioned that it's a place, market is...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Just a little bit closer to you.
Thank you, Ambassador. You mentioned that it's a place of gossip. I'm wondering how do you view the future of market in North Korea, if it's the place of gossip and the information flows in the market, then North Korea might try to control the market even more. But how do you view the future of market in North Korea? Would it be expanded, or would it be working as a place where people can gather and discuss their gruntled emotions towards the government, North Korean government? How do you view that?
I'm quite sure that if the regime could close the markets, it would do so instantly. It regards them, for ideological reasons, as I explained, but also for practical political reasons, as extremely undesirable. And Kim Jong-il himself has made speeches to this effect. But they can't close the markets. They tried to do so in November 2009 and were forced into an embarrassing climb down only a few months later. As I said, May 2010, the regime astonishingly admits it can't solve the food problem. In fact, some of the markets were back by February 2010, and they were back functioning pretty much normally in March 2010. So within, 12 weeks of a savage ban going into effect, the regime has had to eat humble pie. Are they expanding? In one at least of the markets I visited regularly was being expanded in 2008. I mean, they were building extra sections onto it, quite a big job. And the frog markets also seemed to be sprawling wider and wider. Whether they're still expanding now, I'm not sure. I don't have up-to-date information on that. But the regime is stuck. It has to allow the markets, because otherwise, you know, the food distribution system breaks down, and it knows it can't control the gossip there. It's a real headache for it.
Yes, right in front of you, Brett.
Thank you, Ambassador. Is it on? I was wondering if you think that organizations outside of North Korea should be doing more to encourage these markets?
I don't think they need much encouragement. I think they can pretty much be left to get on with it. You know, the North Korean people have worked out what has to be done. They've gone long beyond the point where they need sort of lessons from others in this. Let them crack on with it. Mm.
Chad, do you have another question?
Hi, yeah, you've talked about the frog markets and the more conventional markets, but you know, throughout Pyongyang, when I've been there, I've seen like little blue stalls on a number of corners. You see them in other towns as well, people selling ice cream, liquor, batteries, things like that.
Yeah, of course.
Backwards. Those, for example. Yeah. Are those considered frog markets?
No, those are official stalls. They are... I can't see what those are selling, actually. But yes, ice cream is fairly typical. It's very good ice cream. Little things like namsipang, which are kind of vegetable rolls wrapped up in dough. But no, those are not part of the frog market system. They are, however, a kind of extension of the official market system by another name. You get the same stalls in the same place each day, staffed by the same people selling the same stuff. So it is regulated and official. I read somewhere that those stalls actually started during the 13th Youth and Student Games. So way back in 1989, was it? Thank you, Mr. Bowen, 1989. So they have been around for quite a long time, actually predating the official markets by several years.
Ambassador, as we wrap up, I wondered if you might tell us what the UK ambassador leaving DPRK after 2 years, knowing it might be a while before he's invited back, takes with him or buys as a souvenir from North Korea.
What I buy as a souvenir?
Or take, or maybe you don't buy it.
Yeah. I bought, after furious bargaining, an almost complete set of North Korean propaganda posters, which I'm extremely proud of. Thank you. I smuggled out amounts of North Korean tobacco to give to people I dislike. And I also took out one or two sort of North Korean little clockwork toys to give to various kiddies in my large and sprawling family. But well beyond that, I took away memories of the friendliness of all North Koreans, the many conversations I had with them, of the way that they continue to be cheerful amidst great difficulties and often real physical privations. None of my North Korean friends could remember when they'd last had a hot shower. And in the Korean winter, that's pretty rough. All of them suffered the problems of having to climb stairs because the lifts or even the elevators in their blocks of flats or apartment blocks weren't working, which is bad enough for the able-bodied. If you have an elderly relative in an apartment at the top of a block, it means that you've got a problem. They're stuck there. And they all had terribly monotonous diets. These were outer elite in Pyongyang. They weren't starving, but they got pretty sick of eating pure rice and kimchi pretty much, you know, day after day. And, you know, life was a little bit mundane for them. Mm. For all that, for all the privation they faced, and for all their nervousness in many cases about talking to a senior foreigner, for which some of them could have faced really quite unpleasant consequences, one did, they continued to talk, they continued to smile, and I think it is the memory of those friendships that I'll really take away with me. Thank you.
Oh.